All right, this is Eddie Chang and Stephen Whitaker back again. We have here with us the second guest speaker, Mr. Roth. He was a Holocaust survivor from Auschwitz and Buchenwald.
So, Mr. Roth, can you tell us a little bit about your life prior to being sent to concentration camps?
My life began in a very comfortable, wonderful place called Czechoslovakia, which was basically a democracy, modeled somewhat on the American model. And the reason for that is because the first president of Czechoslovakia spent many years in the United States, in particular the University of Chicago, teaching political science. So my life begins fundamentally not that much different from the life that you all have known. Living in a small city of about 7,000 people, with a variety of people of Catholics and Jews and Protestants and Russian Orthodox, going to school, to a public school, playing soccer, just being a child. So living in a house with parents and grandparents, easy life. My concerns had to do with getting a good grade in school, playing soccer, playing with my friends, doing my homework sometimes, and that's about my life. My father was in a business. He produced railroad ties by the tens of thousands, and therefore it was an upper middle class kind of lifestyle.
So can you just describe to us some conditions of the Auschwitz and Buchenwald concentration camps?
Well, Auschwitz itself are three camps, three major camps. One is a death camp and two slave labor camps. I spent some time in the death camp when I arrived, and the conditions there were, of course, not only horrendous, but totally strange, because you come, in particular my case, I came actually from Hungary, from a ghetto. Now, well, the ghetto certainly was no picnic. It's not a bowl of cherries. Nevertheless, the family was together. We weren't threatened with death, and we didn't even understand. And arriving in Auschwitz, it turned out we arrived there at night. And because it was nighttime, you know, images looked quite different. And the particular image that is seared in my brain is the fact that I get off this train after 3 days being squeezed together in this cattle car. I jump off the train, I look around, and what I see is chimneys, and out of chimneys, flames. You know, like, it's very scary. Imagine being 14 years old, and your parents are not with you. It turns out my parents were in Budapest. And you see this. It was rather scary, to say the least. But that was the death camp, because what happened there, all the Jews who came to Auschwitz II, which is called Birkenau. And that's where the actual gas chambers were located, four of them there. And this is where the selection took place. Of course, I didn't necessarily know that. But that night, I was selected to live, temporarily. My grandparents, my aunts, uncles, cousin, they were moved into one direction, I was in the other direction. So the death camp itself, which is Auschwitz II, sometimes referred to as Birkenau, this is where Jews arrived in a train, and there was a selection. 90% or so, most of the time, not always, sometimes more, sometimes less, immediately went to the gas chamber. Lucky for me, I was selected to live, and from there we went to another part of the camp. Really, it's about 2 miles away. It's called Auschwitz I, which was one of the two slave labor camps. There the conditions were, compared to what? They were horrendous, because I worked with horses, draining swamps, very little food, you know, black coffee for breakfast, some soup for lunch, and a piece of bread at night. And labor was hard. I plowed the fields around Auschwitz. So things were extremely difficult. So you were always hungry, you were always tired. But there was one other aspect of it that Auschwitz had. And that's the fact that even though I survived the first selection, there were other selections. There are some nights we came back from work, and rather than go to our building and get a piece of bread, we would then be marched to an area where we would take showers, which is fine, except for the fact that on occasion there'd be a doctor there, look at you naked and determine if you should continue to live. So the idea that you're coming back from work and you're being marched someplace, and within the next 5, 10, 15 minutes, someone may decide that you ought to die. And that was a very difficult situation. So that was Auschwitz. There was a death march, and after the death march, I wound up in Buchenwald. Buchenwald didn't have a gas chamber. So that was not a death camp. That was a concentration camp. But the conditions were horrendous. By the time I arrived there at the end of January, there was very little food. So you were lucky if you got a boiled potato for a whole day or a bowl of soup. So the conditions were more difficult from the food perspective and from the sanitation perspective, but the positive was that there was no selections as such. However, people died by the thousands because of the conditions.
So prior to being sent to the concentration camps, were you a religious person?
I would say I was an observant person. I observed most of the laws of Judaism. So whether at age 14 I can classify myself as being religious, I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. I grew up in an observant home where we did not work on the Sabbath. We ate only kosher food, and I went to synagogue. So I would say that I was an observant Jew.
So after the Holocaust experience, do you feel that your religious views have changed greatly? Or do you...
My religious views haven't really changed. I think they have matured, because remember, during the Holocaust, I'm 14 and 15 years old. I'm not so sure ideologically or philosophically or theologically I was really particularly mature. Looking at it from perspective of today, I would say, in principle, I haven't changed. What I mean by that is that I look upon the whole relationship between man and God as a partnership. So it's a partnership. I would say man is the junior partner.
So during like the selections during Auschwitz and all these other near-death experiences, did you ever feel that God has, you know, he has thrown you away and, you know, you're not accepted anymore? Did you feel that other Jews in the camps maybe were doubtful of their religion?
I'm sure others have, mm-hmm. because when you look at the Holocaust survivor population, you'll find out all extremes. You find some who... deny that God possibly existed. Those who say, I deny God, but actually have a fight with him, can take him to a court, saying, hey, you did something terrible, God. Come on, shape up. You know. Then there are those who look at it philosophically, and there are those who look at it both philosophically and extremely observant, because they feel that somehow some people haven't really observed, and sort of a punishment, which I think is an insane idea. So you have the extremes. But I would say the preponderance of the Jews remain Jews.
Now, when you were liberated from Buchenwald, how did that feel to you? What was that experience like?
The first moment was euphoric, without a question. Because you suddenly feel yourself that, oh my God, from my perspective, I'm going to reach my 15th birthday, my 16th birthday, rather. I mean, I'm going to live. There's no one out there who is trying to murder me right now. And there's no selection. There's food. So tremendous euphoria. After a while, of course, you begin to eat and you get more comfortable because our conditions became much better. Our clothing became better. My food up. Of course, food was tremendous. But then the issue of, oh my God, I'm alone. What do I do now? I was all of 15 and a half years old in April of 1945. What do I do? And I decided to go back to Czechoslovakia with the logic that, gee whiz, if I survived, maybe someone else did in my family too. So I went back. And of course, I was most fortunate because both my parents, my father and mother, both survived.
So when you... When you ultimately left Czechoslovakia, because obviously you've come to America now and you've been living here, did you immediately become a proponent of tolerance and of Holocaust education? Or what was your life like when you first came to America?
Well, my first thing was to learn how to speak English. Can't be concerned about anything else except being able to communicate with my others, because I wound up in school. To say that I immediately became... talking about the Holocaust, not really, because no one was interested in listening. However, I must point out that my first year in high school, which was Midwood High School in Brooklyn, so I must give them a plug, right? They actually wrote an article about me, about my experience. They asked me questions. There was an interview. It was actually published in their school newspaper. But by and large, people were not interested. It was painful to speak about it, of course, because it's so immediate. In fact, my uncle, who is a wonderful man, who I think everybody should have an Uncle Harry like I did, because he not only cared, but he did everything human possible to make me feel good, and my parents, and helped in tremendous ways. But one of the comments he made when we came here, he says, let the experience sink into the sea. This is a new life, this is a new place, forget it. He meant well, because certainly the experience was horrendous. But I'm not so sure that was good advice. It wasn't until many years later that I had the opportunity to speak about my experience. In particular, about 30-some-odd years ago, when my children, who grew up in this neighborhood, were beginning to look and ask questions, like particularly, you know, short sleeves, I have a tattoo on my arm. You know, what's that tattoo? And, you know, when they were little, real little, I said, gee whiz, that's your mother's telephone number, because she wants to make sure I don't call anybody else except her. But as time went on, of course, I began to give them slowly bits and pieces. And by the time they got to, let's say, fourth, fifth grade, they would study European history. And in fact, my younger one was in one of these classes, and they were studying Europe, in particular Czechoslovakia. So he raises his hand. He says, my father's from Czechoslovakia. Whereupon the teacher says to him, oh, your father's a foreigner. He says, no, he's not a foreigner. He's a continental. So of course, what happens is the teacher finds out about me and eventually asks me to come to the class. So that was like 40 years ago. And I began going to classes, first my children and other people, and slowly I began to speak. And I've been speaking on the Holocaust, on my experiences, issues relating to the Holocaust, I would say 35, 40 years.
What lesson, just as a closing remark, what lesson or what is the main idea you're trying to teach children today by speaking at colleges and universities and high schools?
There are a number of issues. One of them, of course, is the whole issue of bystanders. If some student or some adult picks on somebody, a bully, and if no one stops him, if the rest of the community, whatever community he lives in, it's a school community, does nothing, he'll continue doing it. So the first thing is, look upon the person or persons who are beginning to persecute other people in some way, illegally in whatever way, and make sure you don't stand by and do nothing. That's very critical. The second thing is to understand the step-by-step process from Jews being citizens, full citizens, with all rights in countries like Czechoslovakia, like Germany, how step-by-step their rights were taken away. To know the signposts along the road to Auschwitz and make sure that you watch presence, the present situation at any time. Is any aspect of that happening now? Are we taking away from a particular group rights? Are we limiting what they can do? These are the signposts along the road, because it begins in a very simple fashion. It says, I don't like you. We as a group don't like you, your type. And therefore we're going to ostracize you. We're going to limit what you can do, what you can achieve, and so on. If you see that, because eventually what happens, I don't like you. I don't want you to go to my school. I don't want you to live in my community. I don't want you to live in my state. I don't want you to live at all. So that is another aspect of this. Because if you don't watch out, other genocides are taking place. That's the second part. The third part is that we are our brother's keeper. But having said that, simultaneously, our brother has to be our keeper too. If I help someone, he can't come to me and say, I want to destroy your house. I want to destroy your way of life. So it's a two-way street. We're all on this little space capsule called Earth for a very limited time. We need to be able to live here together and leave something for our children and grandchildren and generations to come. and we hope that we give them something we have contributed. That we don't leave this earth with nothing but consuming. They've done something positive.
Thank you so much, Mr. Roth, for coming to interview with us. Yeah, this is Eddie Chang and Stephen Whitaker. We'll be back in about 15 minutes.